tape 3, side B of the interview with Professor Matthews. And we're about to talk about recruitment in the early years of the department and the difficulty of, or otherwise, of getting people in the appropriate areas.
During 64 and 65, I was concerned with two major things. One, developing the new courses, which meant not just the courses themselves, but the overall structure of the degree as it affected accounting and public finance. Secondly, recruiting people. Although I was looking for people with a joint interest in government accounting and public finance, because of the orientation of the department and the courses, I did need some straight academic accountants, and for that reason we appointed one or two people who had not had much of an interest in the government accounting side, just as we kept on one or two people on the public finance side who had no interest in accounting. Peter Standish, I think, was one of the early appointments coming from Sydney, University of Sydney, and he was mainly a theoretical accountant without much interest in government accounting. Bob Jay was a mainstay of the department right from the time he was appointed in 65, with a major interest both in government accounting and public finance, a willingness to teach in both, and also a willingness to do some teaching in the first year accounting unit on the tutorial side, which was necessary because we had fairly large enrolments with not many staff. But there were others. Not sure what sequence these other people came in. Ronald Maher, who had been a lecturer in the University of Singapore and had subsequently done some work in national accounting and written a book on national accounting, the National Accounts of Singapore, I think, while he was working in the UK. Forgotten whether he was at Cambridge or LSE. He'd previously applied for a job with me in Adelaide, and when we came to the ANU, I'm not sure whether I recruited him or whether he applied for one of the jobs, but he was appointed also, and was also a very valuable member of the staff with joint interests.
What was the normal process of recruitment? Did you decide that you wanted jobs in certain areas and just advertise, or did you go out looking for people and then create the jobs around the people, as it were?
No, mainly the first. We had, you know, we had teaching commitments to meet, and we wanted people who could fulfil those teaching requirements, but that didn't mean we would appoint anybody. In fact, the appointments were all first class. Peter Standish, Ronald Maher. The other chap I was going to mention with a joint interest was one of my old lecturers from University of Adelaide, Jim Henderson. Like John Head, he had been students at Adelaide and subsequently became, Jim Henderson became a lecturer there, and came over to the ANU because he also had a joint interest in government accounting and public finance, although his other interests continued to be on the straight accounting side. So it was really a question of wanting excellent people, and we were prepared to not to make appointments if we couldn't get those people.
And did that happen? Did you not make appointments to certain advertised positions?
Yeah. Sometimes we had to wait quite a long time. Sometimes we made offers to people who were then sort of kept by their own universities with counter offers. In those days, accounting in particular was it was a fairly new subject in most universities. Adelaide was the first university after Melbourne to have full-time accounting staff. And a lot of the people who were in fact being appointed to accounting jobs around the country in the 50s and 60s were people who'd been with me in to senior accounting jobs, people who'd been with me in Adelaide, or who'd come through Melbourne, or had been students or research students of mine.
Presumably then you were less likely to encounter the problem confronted by some other departments of new staff, unknown staff, not fulfilling initial promise.
I think that's true. I think I knew most of the people that we appointed, in fact, before they were appointed.
Did you find...
I hadn't worked with them personally, as was the case with Peter Standish and Ronald Maher, I knew of their work and there was no risk attached to their appointments.
Just looking ahead and without being specific, did you find that there was a problem with what's often referred to as dead wood? People who just reach a certain stage of their career and then fail to produce or cease to be really adequate teachers? Or did you find that people went through cycles of their capacity in certain respects?
I suppose I could name one or two people both in Adelaide and to a lesser extent in the ANU who didn't live up to their promise. I think most of the people in the ANU and all except one in Adelaide lived up to their promise in the sense that they finished up with chairs in other universities or heads of department in CAEs. The one failure was a chap I'd taken over from Horry Brown in the ANU in the University of Adelaide, who we eventually had to get rid of because he was a psychiatric case. To be fair to Horry Brown, he'd warned me that there were problems with it. He was Horry Brown's research student in the ANU and he didn't finish his degree. Horry warned us that there were great risks involved in appointing him and in retrospect we shouldn't have done it, but he seemed to perform well as a tutor and I finished up appointing him to a lectureship, and that was really the only bad appointment I think I'd ever made.
That's obviously a special circumstance, but you never found yourself wanting to give somebody a push either sideways or out?
No. I think right through we had a very good group of people working with us. So it was a pretty cohesive group at that stage. There were some problems later after I went to the centre, but that's another story.
Can we just talk a little bit about students, insofar as you can remember any of the student issues of the day? There was a concern, in the first instance, about the literacy of people arriving to do accountancy courses. Can you recall that as an issue?
just vaguely. I think we're all appalled at the level of education of a lot of the people coming into the economics degree. The reasons for this, in retrospect, are fairly obvious. It was an open university in those days. Anybody who had matriculated could get into the ANU, and this wasn't always possible in the main universities in the state capitals. It may have been true of some of the other state universities, but not the University of Melbourne, University of Sydney, and so on. The result was that for some students, the ANU was a university of last resort, and this gave an odd mixture to our student body. It meant that we were getting some of the best students in the country, and also some of the worst. At that time, economics and accounting were more or less at the bottom of the heap so far as student preferences were concerned. That compares in an interesting way with the present time, when accounting in particular, to a lesser extent economics, is up close to medicine and law as one of the most preferred disciplines. Change in the market situation, of course, but accounting was still a relatively unknown university discipline, and a lot of the people we were getting were people who hadn't been admitted to other faculties. So that with this mixture of students, some very good, some dreadful, we had problems not only in teaching but also in examining. And the failure rate was very high. It was a continuing problem of the faculty to know what to do about this. Burge Cameron, I remember, undertaking a lot of studies to try to ascertain the reason for this, to see whether it was just the fault of the students, or whether there were things that the faculty should do by way of teaching and examining. When I was dean, I think this was something that may well have been going on before, but was certainly continued subsequently. We wanted to make sure that there were no inconsistent results, and before the results were published, we did comparisons of the results of individual students across all subjects, counting, economics, economic history, statistics, political science, and whatever optional subjects they may have been doing. And on the whole, the results were pretty consistent across disciplines, except the pass rates in the arts-type disciplines tended to be a bit higher than those in economics and accounting. But economics and accounting were always pretty close together. Nevertheless, I remember while I was dean, I had to defend the examination failure rates before the council each year. Nugget Coombs in particular was concerned about this, I remember. And we felt at the time that there was not much we could do about it except to raise entrance standards and require a higher standard of entry. There was something of an argument at that stage that a lot of students who couldn't get decent results in matriculation nevertheless did pretty well subsequently in universities, and that was true of some students, because as well as sheer ability, I think motivation and hard work count for a good deal in a university course. But I think Burge Cameron's work showed that the high failure rates were mainly concentrated on the people that had very poor matriculation results. I'm not sure what it was called, the high school certificate in those days. And
67 would have been the first cohort.
And I think we were satisfied that whatever faults we may have had on teaching and examining, that that was the main cause of the problem.
What was Coombs's concern, or was there an implication in his concern that the department was somehow at fault?
I think so. I think the council felt that the high failure rates were a part of a policy of exclusion, you know, that we just wanted to maintain unreasonably high standards. That was not the case, because I think that the problem was not just to get... the high failure rates, I might say, were mainly concentrated in accounting one. I think there should have been a concern to the extent that these spilled over into second and year, third year student units, and they did in some cases, and that was more doubtful. But in accounting one, we were concerned to make sure that people didn't get through who were subsequently going to be blocked by the much more difficult work in accounting two, in accounting and economics two, and accounting and economics three.
Can we digress just slightly to talk about the role of council, because this seems to be one of those interesting instances where council is expressing an opinion, perhaps putting pressure on something which could be regarded as a purely academic question. Was there indignation on the part of the department that council should be interfering in matters of academic policy? And who on council was interfering? Was it just Coombs, who I guess could get away with anything in the university, or were there other members of council as well?
No, I don't think we... I was a member of council at that stage. I don't think I felt, and I don't think any other members in the faculty felt, that it was an improper concern of council to worry about high failure rates. As a member of council myself, I think it is a proper concern. Last year, I was involved in a review of the accounting discipline in higher education for the Commonwealth Government, which meant reviewing the performance of all 50 institutions at that stage offering accounting courses. And I must say, I was appalled by the lack of any sort of control over examination results in most of those institutions. For example, individual departments were able to have a failure rate of about 70 or 80%, and other departments in the same year were failing only 20 or 30% of students. The same student was being failed by one department, passed well in the other three departments, and nobody was asking any questions about this. We were told ridiculous things by some lecturers. We talked to all the staff as well as to groups of students as we went around. One lecturer told us that company law is a very difficult subject. It's just not possible for most students to pass it at the first attempt. Similarly, lecturers in other subjects made these bold statements that were not subject to any sort of control. So I think academic freedom can be carried to undue lengths, and it is a proper thing for the faculty, first of all. Well, first of all, I think the head of the department, then the faculty, then the academic board, and then the council ought to be concerned with these things if the proper controls are not in place. What I'm saying is that I think proper controls were in place in our faculty in the 1960s, and the high failure rates were due to other causes.
In various parts of the university, there's a great emphasis on the notion of academic autonomy. I'm thinking in particular, for example, of JCSMR, where I could imagine that if academic standards were questioned on council, there would be great concern in principle expressed in faculty of JCSMR. Do you think that there's a difference there between the Faculty of Economics, perhaps, and some other faculties? And I take JCSMR just as an example.
No, the concern, I think, of the council in those days was not just with the Faculty of Economics, it was with all faculties. It seems to me to be appropriate for a university council to be concerned with the level of performance overall. This doesn't mean that it should interfere in detailed matters, but I would have thought it's the council's responsibility to have a system in place that makes sure that people do perform. I think it's going to extreme lengths nowadays in the opposite direction. I think this is one of the reasons for the problems in the John Curtin School and in other parts of the Institute, that it's been too much a closed shop without proper review procedures. I think the review procedures are taking place, but it was too easy in the old days for an ANU department to become quite moribund without anybody ever questioning that. I could name one or two departments that everybody in Australia knew were dead. But the council didn't concern itself with those. My argument would be that it should have. not as an individual department, to make sure that proper review processes were in place.
Did you express that view on council on any occasion? Were there occasions where you would have liked council to have taken stronger action and that it didn't?
No, I think I'd have to say not, because the occasion didn't arise, you see. I think I suppose there would have been an opportunity when the reports of the various schools came in. As a new boy, I certainly wasn't going to rock the boat at that stage.
Can we just go back to student matters, just very briefly, perhaps?
Just before you leave that, I'm not suggesting that I approve of what the present government has done by way of interfering in university matters. Rather, the reverse. I think I would argue, though, that to some extent what the government has done has resulted from a failure on the part of universities generally to become more accountable. And this thing that we've been talking about is part of the business of being accountable.
Back on students, do you have any clear recollections of the troubles of the early 70s, as they were called? Particularly, did you find that your students were involved significantly, or did they tend to be rather more conservative than perhaps art students?
We're talking about a time now when I was sort of disengaging from teaching, because most of the trouble started after I'd moved to the Centre for Research on Federal Financial Relations, even though I was nominally head of the accounting department for accounting and public finance department for some time. Once Alan Barton was appointed after I'd left, he became the head, and my last teaching was done in 1972. I think I'd need to go back to the 1960s though and say that I think a lot of the the problems arose with students because of this same lack of accountability that I just talked about in relation to academic staff. I think there was a general move on the part of students and on the part of some people in the university, Jack Crawford in particular, especially after he became Vice-Chancellor, to make academic staff more accountable for their teaching. I think from Nugget Coombs' point of view, when he was Chancellor, talking about things like failure rates, he was very much on top of what was happening, and this was one of the reasons why he was raising these questions in council. It was just too easy for, in a lax department, for university staff to get away with murder, insufficient proper preparation of lectures, insufficient care with marking of assignment questions and insufficient preparation of tutorial classes, inadequate preparation of examination material, inadequate checking of examination results. As head of department, I tried to overcome all these things by keeping a pretty tight rein on individual staff and making sure that they were keeping up to the mark. With their consent, I didn't do it without it, having their agreement. I used to drop in occasionally to lectures or tutorials just to listen to what was going on. I used to carefully, we had a department meeting, of course, to decide on all matters affecting courses and teaching allocations and that sort of thing. But once the jobs were assigned, I used to try to keep some watch over the way in which work was being done. It was especially necessary at examination time. I found that lecturers intended to be very careless in the setting of examination questions, for example, and in accounting, like mathematics. I mean, you can ask questions that are not capable of being answered if you're not very careful. In numerical questions, that is. And in these ways, I think both the head of the department and the individual lecturers themselves need to be kept on the mark. Well, I don't think this was happening everywhere through the university. I think some students seldom saw their lecturers. Difficulties were not easily explained because they couldn't get in touch with staff. The problem was less acute in Australia than it was in UCLA, but it was notorious that in UCLA and in other universities, a lot of the student revolt was caused by the fact that students didn't even see lecturers, I mean, in courses for which the lecturers were nominally responsible. They were busy out doing consulting work and making a lot of money on the side. So I had a good deal of sympathy with the beginnings of the movement by students to get more say over what was happening. I don't think there were any special problems in the Faculty of Economics. I doubt if I could name a lecturer there that I could say I thought wasn't doing his job properly. But I doubt if that was true through all of the university.
You obviously took the role of leadership as head of department very seriously.
Well, I felt responsible, you see, that was the reason, yeah.
And also in relation to research, did you keep a careful eye on the research output and interests of your staff?
It's more difficult to prod people into doing research, but I certainly maintained an interest in what they were doing, and in many cases this was achieved through them working with me. Bob Jay, for example, worked with me on two major books, and a number of other papers. Ronald Maher subsequently became a joint author in one of my other books. I was able to maintain an interest in the work that most of them were doing because it corresponded to my own research interests, and that meant looking at drafts of their work, commenting on it, showing them drafts of my work likewise for comments.
We must pause there, or you'll be cut off in mid-sentence. Mm-hmm.